Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners, all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello and welcome to the SaifEdDean.com podcast seminar. In today's episode, we've got a special guest, one of my favorite people on Twitter and one of my oldest Bitcoin Twitter connections, and somebody who was very influential in guiding me down the right path of Bitcoin and figuring out what was going on. Michael Goldstein, better known on Twitter as Bidstein, who is, along with Pierre Rochard, one of the co-founders of the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, whose writings I've recommended before on this podcast, and I recommend you check them out again. The Satoshi Nakamoto Institute has been around since 2012 or 13, Michael?
13.
Yeah, 2013. So 7 years now of just telling the world that Bitcoin is going to take over and being vindicated day after day. And then watching as, you know, shitcoiners' heads explode as they just continue to come and go and come and go, and shitcoins come and go while Bitcoin just remains there. So Michael has been at the forefront of this war for Bitcoin supremacy since 2013. And his writings and the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute were quite influential in helping me understand it, because I think, you know, there are a lot of people who've written about Bitcoin and have explained it from a technical perspective, but to begin to understand the economic consequences of Bitcoin and the economic consequences of hard money and the economic consequences of having a form of money that is hard and that is hard to shut down before the government,
are something that is becoming clearer to more people now. But at the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, they've held it, they've maintained this for many, many years. And it's absolutely amazing to watch Wall Street companies and all kinds of people now begin to repeat the mantras of Satoshi Nakamoto Institute. So, Michael, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining.
Thank you. It's an honor.
It's a lot of fun, and I'm sure, and I should also add, of course, Michael is also a carnivore, and the funny coincidence is that Michael and I began carnivore diets at the same time. Coincidentally, we knew each other at that time, and we didn't know each other very well, and we were chatting about Bitcoin and food, and he sent me a link of a website and saying, "Can you believe those people are going to be trying out meat and water, are just living on meat and water?" And I said, "Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, I'm going to be beginning this as a trial over next month." And he was about to begin it. And it's been 5 years since then. And we've both been eating basically nothing but meat since then. We've shared a few steaks during those 5 years. And today we're going to be discussing both these topics, Bitcoin and meat, and how they relate to one another. So let's first begin with Bitcoin. I wanted to ask you, Michael, about your famous article, "Everyone is a Scammer," which can really aggravate people and rub them the wrong way when they first read it. But I think after the first few years, people eventually acquire the taste for it and start understanding it and liking it. So can you explain to us why everyone is a scammer?
Yeah, so that's an article that I wrote in September. It's actually September 11th, 2014. And it's basically, I really don't write much. I should write more. But it's also like I've put that one out and people loved it so much, it's hard to follow up. But yeah, that article came out of just the fact of mulling over the potential of Bitcoin and taking it super seriously. So at the time, Bitcoin, I guess, was probably, you know, it was, I don't even remember what the price was, a couple hundred bucks. And so it's a bit absurd to sit there being like, oh yeah, no, this is going to be totally like $10 million a coin. And yet there we were saying that because there was a bit of, you know, chest bumping and, you know, just being idealistic, but also having just a strong understanding, I think, of the hard realities of monetary competition. So we understood by that point that, you know, there is no equilibrium between free market currencies. One will tend to dominate completely. And because we saw the fundamentals of Bitcoin as so strong and so superior to that which fiat currencies can offer, and even what precious metals could offer, Bitcoin was just, it seemed like the obvious thing to take over. And if it's going to take over, well, like I said, it's going to have a price that is unfathomable at the time. In this case, you know, it's easy to imagine a $10 million Bitcoin as a bearish estimate. Now, the implications of this are very great because at the time, we still see remnants of this today. But at the time, there was a heavy focus on, you know, wanting to spend Bitcoins. I can admit, you know, in 2013, when I was first getting into Bitcoin and a bit into my first forays into Bitcoin, there was a drive to want to, like, you know, proselytize Bitcoin to every merchant you go to, like, hey, do you accept Bitcoin? Because you want to spend Bitcoin. But as you start to realize, like, no, this thing really is going to be, you know, $10 million a piece in the future, you start to realize, like, well, why would I want to spend it? Why would I want to give up my Satoshis when I can give up my dollars instead? In fact, you used to joke back then of just like the idea of like, I can't believe these people are taking dollars. Like, this Bitcoin thing exists and I'm able to just go to a store and they'll just accept my fiat currency. So everyone's a scammer is a way of looking at the world with the understanding that this thing is very valuable in the future, even if it doesn't seem so valuable today. And because of that, you know, you are going to have a much more future-oriented outlook, and one that is going to make you much less interested in any particular goods and services that you can acquire today, because you're more interested in what you can acquire in the future. And this means, like, you know, suddenly I don't care so much about t-shirts. I don't care as much about coffee or pizza or, you know, any of these little things. I don't even know if I care as much about, you know, buying a house, you know, with Bitcoin. It's really like, you know, how do we buy a, you know, moon base and stuff like that? And that's going to take time for Bitcoin to grow and the economy to catch up and give me something that my in return for what my Bitcoins are actually worth. And so because of that, you can look at all the different actors in Bitcoin as, you know, fighting over a scarce resource. And, you know, they're kind of enemies in that sense. Like, the economy is not a zero-sum game, but Bitcoin is a scarce good. It's truly scarce. And so at this time, it's like, if you have a Bitcoin, someone else does not. And if someone has a Bitcoin, you do not. And if you want to think far into the future, you have to think about your self-interest with regard to space on the Bitcoin ledger. And so, you know, I talk about how, first of all, there's actual scams all around, especially at that time. There was some extremely blatant ones too. There was like a Ponzi scheme where you sent Bitcoins to an address that was literally address one Ponzi and then a bunch of other stuff as a vanity address. And people were falling for it. I forget. I have it in the article. I don't remember how much they acquired, but it was a rather absurd amount of money that they acquired through this simple Ponzi scheme that was explicitly a Ponzi scheme. There was also a lot of hacks, and with hacks in Bitcoin, especially because of the nature of Bitcoin transactions, you never know if it's an inside job, if they got attacked by an outside person. It's like this really, it's really opaque with the what you can actually know about what happened, and you can trust, you know, different people's stories about what happened, but it's really hard to know at the end of the day, just as an outside observer. That's not to accuse anyone of actually doing anything, but taking seriously what information you have, there's only so much you can know. So there was all that stuff. There were thefts. So there was just like a lot of actual, like, shall we say, like, you know, criminal behavior going on, of outright fraud and scams and that. But then it's also, you have to think about yourself. And if you want more in the future and you're giving up your chance for that now, you're kind of scamming yourself. So really, like, everyone's a scammer can also be understood as, like, here are all the ways that you can find yourself scamming yourself. And the solution is to view everyone as a scammer. There's fine print at the bottom of the article that very few people actually bothered to read, that scammer is a heuristic, not an accusation. So, you know, a merchant who is accepting Bitcoin, they're not a scammer for accepting Bitcoin. They're making a completely rational economic decision. But you, as the person who goes to buy something, you're scamming yourself if paying for a good in Bitcoin does not actually align with your stated self-interest for the future. And so you just have to keep these things in mind. So I talk about how merchants are scammers because you're giving up your Bitcoins to a merchant who, especially at that time, it's a little different in the age of BTC Pay Server. But at the time then, in the BitPay days, a lot of merchants would accept Bitcoins and then they just, you know, they'd trade that in for dollars immediately. So really, like, the Bitcoins were just flowing into the hands of not even the merchant. The merchant wasn't using that to invest in their business and build a Bitcoin reserve treasury like companies are today. They were just passing it on, and they were just using the fact that you were excited about this thing to sell you stuff that you could have just as easily bought with fiat. But I also point out how that's a good thing, because merchants are also increasing the liquidity of Bitcoin by giving you more ways that you could potentially spend Bitcoins, because you do eventually want to spend Bitcoins on something. That's the point of having them, is the belief that sometime in the future there could be a use that's more valuable than today. So it's actually a good thing. And having merchants that are accepting Bitcoin also creates, you know, technological incentive to be creating things like debit cards and you know, credit cards and all kinds of tools that allow the hodler to make more of his unit of account be in Bitcoin rather than fiat terms. So that's a very good thing. I also talked about investments. So back in 2013 and 2014, there was what I've called the Scambrian explosion. There's all these, you know, copycats of Bitcoin coming out. There's Litecoin and Aurora Coin and PP Coin. I guess that one was a early proof of stake coin. There's all these like, you know, stuff, and they would just come out with a Bitcoin talk announcement thread, and they change a logo, change the number of units. Maybe you have faster blocks, all that kind of stuff. They were never adding like actually interesting features. It's actually something that they've gotten more sophisticated on. At least they try to add a feature. And over time,
graphic design too.
Yes. Well, so the history of altcoins has been a history in web design, because it went from simple Bitcoin talk threads to making a simple Bootstrap, Twitter Bootstrap landing page, to then like Ethereum blew it out of the water. Ethereum got the best web designers. They had all the fancy, you know, parallax animation stuff. So that's how you know it's a really good investment.
No, they really set the bar very high for the you know, the stupid vaporware that has great web design. I don't think anybody can outdo Ethereum for a very long time. Like to take a completely worthless scam and put such good web design on it was truly revolutionary. I mean,
it's fantastic.
Fantastic for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're definitely the you know, the trendsetters when it comes to scamming in this field.
Yeah. So what I was pointing out then, so I focus on Ethereum in this article, and at the time, Ethereum was vaporware. There was, you know, we can joke about it perhaps being called vaporware or something today. Say maybe Ethereum 2.0 could be kind of joked that way or something. But at the time, Ethereum did not exist yet. It was a white paper that had been written, and people were pouring millions of dollars worth of Bitcoins into I forget what they call it, the Exodus address, sort of to do the pre-sale for Ethereum. Like I said, there was like, I think it was about $15 million. It was the second largest online crowdfund ever at the time. And all this money was being put there, and there was not yet a product at all. So one thing that I do have to say in light of history and where we are today, I do give credit to Ethereum to launching a product, regardless of how I feel about that product, because at the time, it did seem like vaporware. The point in my article, though, was ultimately that when you look at all of these investment opportunities, you have to view them through a Bitcoin lens. So when you look at the return on investment, you can't look on it at it based on how well did it do against the dollar. You have to look how well did it do against Bitcoin. And someone might actually run the numbers and show me how if you got in on the Ethereum pre-sale, you might actually be up. I don't know the numbers on that. At this point, my arguments against that would have more to do with the monetary policy and the actual ability to run the numbers for real, the numbers that matter.
There's no doubting that Ethereum has worked well as a scam for the insiders who got in early. There's no questioning that, but it's not going to work for anybody else because it doesn't do anything else.
Yeah. And Ethereum aside, just for literally any investment, Pierre, our friend Pierre, has taken it so far as, buying a chair. Like, we have to think about, you know, what are the opportunity costs of buying a chair versus the value of Bitcoin.
And I think this is really the thing that your article helped spur, is just this notion of measuring opportunity cost in Bitcoin has really been a very powerful idea that is beginning to spread all around the world. And, you know, you see somebody like Michael Saylor talk about things in this way today. And I think it's just extremely powerful because Bitcoin exists as an alternative for anybody that they could access it. Anybody can buy Bitcoin and anybody can have the returns or the increased appreciation that Bitcoin produces. And so everything else is taken away from your Bitcoin. So now your opportunity cost has changed drastically. And I think this is enormously important in when we discuss changes in time preference. I think this is at the root of it, because now we have this opportunity cost, which is holding a hard money, which is liquid and saleable all over the world. And you can send it around the world in an hour or so. So that becomes a very high opportunity cost for you. And the other thing is, on the one hand, it was the opportunity cost. And then once people start to think of that, I mean, you really helped transition Bitcoin from the narrative of PayPal 2.0 to people understanding, no, this is not PayPal 2.0. This is more like the BIS 2.0 or the IMF 2.0. This is an international monetary framework. This is gold 2.0, and this is not PayPal. And if you look in 2013 and 2014, most Bitcoin startups at that time were focused on Bitcoin payments. And the sad thing, I think, for a lot of Bitcoiners is that, you know, back in 2011 and 2012 and 2013, many of the early adopters held Bitcoins that today would be worth a fortune that is life-changing for them. And they held it and they spent it all the time because they were thinking that, you know, what we need to do in order to get this Bitcoin machine going is to, it's kind of a Keynesian conception that if we just keep spending, then just like the idea of government stimulus, if government spends enough money, then everybody starts doing jobs for one another and then the economy picks up. And similarly, you know, if you take your paycheck and then instead of keeping it in your checking account, you go and you buy Bitcoin and then you find people who are selling things for Bitcoin and start buying their things. Well, then if you do this and then others do this and everybody does this, then suddenly everybody is buying and selling things in Bitcoin and Bitcoin is adopted as the global money. But I think it's become clear that A, that's not very workable. All the startups that use this as a model haven't really done well. And B, the people who tried to do this have ended up paying a very high price for it. I mean, the people who held like $500 worth of Bitcoin in 2012 that would be absolutely life-changing today if they'd held on to them. But instead, they have a couple of T-shirts and socks with Bitcoin logos on them because they thought we're helping kickstart the circular economy of Bitcoin.
I think in the merchant section of this article, I mean, one of the main points that I'm trying to get across is you don't want to get, and this is something that, Daniel had harped on before me in another article. In many ways, this article was me synthesizing like all the stuff we had talked about at SNI into like, okay, for real, like if this thing is going to be worth this much, let's take it seriously. How do we apply these ideas? But with the merchant adoption, you know, other people accepting Bitcoins, that's not interesting at all, because like I said, they can just go sell it for dollars themselves, and that's actually just driving the price of Bitcoin down at the margins. What you really want is to create demand for Bitcoin, and saving Bitcoins is a better way to create demand. And saying, you know, I am hoarding Bitcoin and no, you can't have any, as one of the articles was titled, that signals to people, this is a thing that I highly value. Perhaps you should be valuing it too if you learned about it.
Yeah, I think the idea that it is the Bitcoin token itself that is valuable, and the Bitcoin token is not like a casino chip where you just you're holding it so that you can enter play a game with it and then cash it out for other stuff. I think once people understood that it's actually the money itself that's valuable and holding it itself that is what is valuable, that's when Bitcoin really, I think, got the intellectual foundation to make a real solid case for why it's held. I think this is what attracts people like Michael Saylor and Paul Tudor Jones right now. They're not looking for a cheaper PayPal. They're not looking to save on their credit card fees. Who cares about how much credit card fees they what they're looking for is an asset that they can hold in their reserve. And the people, unfortunately, who thought about it as a something that we just need to keep moving between ourselves until the economy picks up, paid a pretty heavy price for that, unfortunately.
Yes. Agreed. And I think, savings is, pretty much your entire brand has been built on this idea that like savings is highly underrated.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think, most people had never really thought about saving as being something important. Saving was just, for most people today, because of the way that fiat money functions, as Michael Saylor calls it, it's a melting ice cube. Saving is just the inefficiency that you have to deal with, where sometimes money ends up staying in your bank account for a few days or weeks or months while you figure out a place to put it away. And right. I think with the hard money, when you start thinking of saving as actually the bedrock of your financial stability, and then after you've built your savings, then you start thinking about investment in opportunities that make sense, because you have the bedrock of saving in an asset that appreciates slightly. It completely changes the way that you make your economic decisions. And Pierre, our friend, has whipped this horse beautifully to death over and over and over again about just how the low savings and the fiat money that is melting like an ice cube encourages what he calls the high velocity trash economy, where you have to spend it. And even if you don't find something that you really enjoy, it's better to spend it on something now than watch it depreciate. It's better to invest in an investment that doesn't actually make sense for you rather than just watch it depreciate. And so people are like, they're being put on a treadmill and they have to constantly be running just to stay in their place. Yeah. Whereas with a hard money, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
So thank you, Bitcoin.
Well, so like stepping back a bit, when we were writing and discussing these ideas back in 2013, 2014, there were people who they thought we were crazy. Like after I wrote this article, I got one of the best compliments I can remember getting, which was someone criticizing me, saying like, I can't tell if this is serious or handcrafted artisanal trolling. And later on, I've had people ask me like, you guys didn't like actually believe this at the time, right? Like being that bullish back then. And it's like, no, we absolutely did.
Yep. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, eventually the joke would end and you guys would fold and crack up and start laughing about it. But no, it's the world that's going to fold and join you.
Yeah. So that's why, back then there was like this, we always said everything with this like shit eating grin, because we knew how crazy we sounded, but we also knew how right we were. but the reason that we could have those ideas is because we came out of, the Austrian boot camp. We went through the gauntlet of reading Mises and Rothbard and Hoppe and Hayek and Holzman and Huerta de Soto. And
what got you down that rabbit hole? How did you get into that so young and so early?
Well, so I found it in high school after the financial crisis happened. I was generally, I would say, smart kid or whatever, but it was a real punch in the face when I realized like I'm hearing all these buzzwords or jargon or whatever on the radio as the financial crisis is happening, and I realized like I don't actually know what any of this means. I don't actually know anything about economics. And so I asked someone I knew who seemed to know a little bit about economics, like, hey, I want to learn about economics. Teach me. The reason I knew he knew about economics is because he called himself an anarcho-capitalist. And was like, oh, capitalist, he must know a thing or two. And first thing he sent me was Leonard Reed's iPencil and some Rothbard. And I read that and I immediately clicked. It was like, oh, this is what a market is. You need a market in order to even just have a pencil. You don't want to mess with that thing. Yeah. And so that got me on the right track. And I spent, you know, the last nearly half of high school and all of college just diving into Austrian economics. And so by time Bitcoin came around, I was a gold maximalist. You know, there was not as much of a strategic vision of how we could possibly recreate the gold standard. But I was absolutely certain that it's like, well, we need to have the gold standard or a precious metal standard in order to have a thriving society again. And at the time, it also felt like, well, maybe this thing really does need to crash, and then people have to, you know, glom onto precious metals so they can save themselves. Thankfully, you know, with Bitcoin, it creates a more positive vision, such that, you know, hopefully things do not go further south. If they do, Bitcoin is a lifeboat, but also Bitcoin is so great that even if things manage to chug along just fine, Bitcoin will just eat everything up and will move in a very peaceful transition. And you've helped me sharpen my thoughts on that. But yeah, so I was already like talking about money in the way that I talk about Bitcoin, just not with Bitcoin as the money. Now, the caveat, I was never a shit coiner with cryptocurrencies, but I did have a soft spot for silver back in my gold, quote unquote, gold maxi days. I guess I was like, I was a Charlie Lee of gold, because I owned some silver and stuff like that, because, oh, gold's too expensive. So yeah. I had to learn the hard way. But once I was in Bitcoin, I no longer fell for such ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the transition from being a gold person to a Bitcoin person is, you know, on top of just it's not such a big ideological jump. It's not such a big intellectual jump to make, because the two are similar once you really get Bitcoin. But I think in the way that it changes your outlook on life, it's actually quite profound. Because with gold, as you said, because of the lack of Bitcoin's most important technical feature, which is NGU technology, as I like to call it, number go up technology, gold doesn't have the draw that would bring people in voluntarily. And so you look at gold bugs even until today, you know, there's that doomsday lesson of, look, the world is going to go to hell unless we switch to the gold standard. Or, you know, so either we switch to the gold standard now, or the world is going to go to hell and then we'll end back on gold anyway. And so both, you know, regardless of whether the two are true or not, it's just a very hard sell to tell people. People don't want to hear that the world is ending, and they don't want to take responsibility, and they don't want to try and fix it. And of course, you know, the way that we fix it is through political processes and voting, yeah, and all that stuff. And
oh, and look at how long, you know, Ron Paul spent decades, yeah, trying to get us to end the Fed. He did a great job evangelizing, because the whole, absolutely, reason any of us care about the Fed, I would trace back to Ron Paul.
Absolutely. And then, but in terms of political activism, I mean, it's you know, he hasn't even managed to audit the Fed, and it's been God knows how many decades that he's been trying.
Yeah. So with all of this in mind, having this Austrian basis coming into Bitcoin, I think kind of gave a superpower ideologically, because we didn't fall for all these kind of monetary myths. And with regards to savings, as we were talking about earlier, in Austrian economics, we know that in order to have capital, you need savings prior. And so, you know, once again, it's like you can see not only like as you said, the financial stability, it's like you need to know that you're going to eat tomorrow before you can even think about spending tomorrow building capital that helps you acquire more food.
Absolutely.
So I recommend everyone read Erwin Schiff's How the Economy Grows and Why It Doesn't. by the graphic novel. That's Peter Schiff's dad. It's actually a really fantastic explanation of these economic basics.
Yeah, I'm going to post a link to that one as well. And Leonard Reed's essay, Eye Pencil, is also excellent. We'll post a link to that. Yeah, these are excellent. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, so the last thing in Everyone's a Scammer was also pointing out and you know, putting the mirror up to myself. It was like, hoarders are also scammers. So here I was, talking about the virtues of hoarding Bitcoin. So, oh, you must be like a good person. Right? It's like, well, you should also view other hoarders and yourself as effectively a scammer because, like, you know, just yesterday, someone sold their Bitcoins for $13,000. And if you think in the whole history of Bitcoin, there's been someone who's been selling Bitcoins on the other side of the trade at, you know, everything from $0 to $19,000. There's been someone on the other side of that trade and they gave up their Bitcoins for that. Now, some of those people, maybe they had, you know, short-term needs they needed to cover. There's probably also a lot of people who saw Bitcoin reach a certain price and thought, well, it can't go any higher than that. And so they sold. Some of them may have even, you know, sold at the top at 19,000 and they felt pretty good the past couple of years, but coming up, they might find that hard money, you know, does not work in that way. And it just, you know, it's going to keep dominating. And 19,000 is going to feel like a blip on the radar going into the future. And that person, you know, will have to live with the fact that they had sold and perhaps not gotten back in time. And they gave up a ticket on the seat for a seat on the Bitcoin train. So hoarders are also, scamming people by actually like convincing them. It's like, oh yeah, no, this $13,000 is totally enough to be buying that Bitcoin for you, I swear. Yeah. And the other person falls for it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, in reality, everybody has a diminishing marginal utility for everything. Money happens to be the thing with the least diminishing marginal utility because it's the thing that can be exchanged for anything else. So its marginal utility declines by the decline of all other goods, you know, because all other goods individually, you know, your next apple or your next orange or your next car, it's each added unit has a declining marginal utility. But each added unit of all goods together will decline at a much slower rate. And that's what money has. So,
but I think people have misunderstood like kind of the maximalist position. It's like sort of, oh, like they'll shame you for ever selling. It's like, well, no, if you have a reason to sell, like I don't care what your preferences are and what you need in life. Like I want you to do whatever you think will do you best. My only point is that considering that you say own, you know, a millibit today, that might not be worth but $10 today, but in the future it might be worth, you know, $1,000. And so was it in your best interest to give it up for, a lunch or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, what happened since getting into Bitcoin is that all of my purchases and just decisions and how I spend my time have become just much higher quality. Everything has a much higher bar to clear before I can decide to spend any of my time or my Bitcoin on it. And it makes you very discerning and it makes you, it gives you a mind of your own. No, I don't want to buy your stupid thing that you want me to buy. And I'm not going to spend my time talking about the stupid things that you want me to talk about just because, you know, I value it. I have a high opportunity cost. And this is primarily, I think, ultimately, when people talk about toxic Bitcoin maximalists, all of the people getting their knickers in a twist about us being toxic are just basically annoyed that we won't sit there and listen to their pitch about their stupid shitcoin scam. It's ultimately what it comes down to is like, why wouldn't you treat my proprietary stupid shitcoin with the same veneration that you give to Bitcoin? Or why wouldn't you listen about all of this new scammy stuff that we're working on? We're going to implement Internet 2.0 and we're going to do, you know, the all of these stupid buzzwords. And somehow you're supposed to sit and listen and just be open-minded about all those things. And open-minded does not mean that you allow anybody to dump whatever garbage in your mind. Open-minded means that you're very discerning about leaving your mind open to the ideas that are worth engaging in. You're not just going to, because, you know, your time is scarce, just like Bitcoin is scarce. It's a very powerful lesson that you learn from Bitcoin.
Right. Well, and having savings allows you to demand more out of life.
Yeah.
When you have savings, you know, you don't have to go with, you know, say whatever car just gets you to from point A to B. If you like cars, having more savings allows you to choose on other dimensions as well. It's like, well, I want to get from A to B. I also want to look stylish doing it. And I have a specific aesthetic that I like. People might want the Lambo, some might want the Rolls Royce. But it's only having savings that you can make these demands. But also those demands, you know, they necessarily crowd out, you know, other potential things that you could buy. And so, yes, some people don't like it when you don't want to buy their things. But, you know, it's your money and it's up to you to decide what you want to do with it.
And I think even better than this is just the selection, the selectivity you develop about what you want to work with. And I think this is something that fiat people will absolutely love about a Bitcoin world. And even we don't even need a Bitcoin world for that. Once you have some Bitcoin savings, you're no longer in the position where you constantly need to be working every day for whatever comes up because you need to pay the bills. If you have the financial security of a hard money, you're able to, you know, pass up on a job that doesn't interest you in order to wait for the job that you really care about. You're able to spend some time not being an office slave so that you can have a few months to focus on building your own project. And, you know, we see this in the Bitcoin space that many, many people use the financial security and the freedom that Bitcoin allows them quit the job that they don't like and to work on the things that they do like. And I am a prime example. Before Bitcoin, I was at a university teaching Keynesian economics and having to publish in stupid journals that nobody reads to try and keep the job. And, you know, Bitcoin changes that. Bitcoin fixes this. Now I can teach on my own website. I can communicate with interested readers and learners directly, and I'm much more efficient at it, and I'm building something that I like and that I enjoy. And it's, you know, if you apply this to a society, if we live in a world in which we go from just a few individual weirdos like you and me doing this to a world in which everybody does this, that's how you end up with what the gold standard looked like. That's what the world was like in the 19th century. You look at all of these people who invented all these incredible things like airplanes and electronics back in the late 19th century. They were all small business owners who had their own capital, and they were working in their spare time on their hobbies. You know, one guy invents an airplane and another guy invents a machine that does this and that. And it's that freedom, the financial security of having savings, having your own capital, that allows you the freedom to, you know, take weekends off to try and invent an airplane. Thousands of people were doing that in the late 19th century, and one of them managed to pull it off. Well, two of them, the Wright brothers, managed to pull it off.
I remember being reading a lot about the history of science. It was something I was very interested in high school, and I was struck by how many of the big telescopes from back in the day were privately funded.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that I know you're passionate about, is just the private production of scientific research and how much superior that is. And I think all of this is very connected. And even for people like, you know, I was a college kid when I was really getting to Bitcoin. So sadly, I'm mostly still a wage slave. But in a Bitcoin world, and when you start to get your hands on Bitcoins, you can know that what you're able to put away is buying you freedom in the future. So you are buying your freedom. It's just, you know, it's perhaps a little farther away than for people who were able to buy it sooner. And with that, it can also allow people to be more kind of mission oriented of like, you know, work as the thing that they need to do to get done because they have a goal in mind, as opposed to this endless treadmill that's just, you know, completely depressing because you go to work every day and you're not even moving anywhere in life. Bitcoin, you know, breaks you free of that and views it as sort of work like that would be like a sort of necessary evil. And it's like, well, I got to do this thing. I got to go to the coal mine. But when I come back, I have a little bit of money that I get to put into Bitcoins. And one day I will no longer have to go to the coal mine. And it, I think that's one of those things that also makes life sufferings a little more sufferable.
Absolutely. And I entirely agree. Anybody have anything else they'd like to ask Bitsteam before we move on to discussing meat and steak on the Bitcoin world? Yeah, Tim?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yes, I quite like to ask what your view on the future of, say, something like the Lightning Network is. Are you someone that thinks that in the future we're going to be transacting with Bitcoin, you know, as a daily occurrence, or do you think that the store of value narrative is going to be the one that stands the test of time?
So I think that sets up a slightly false dichotomy. So I think as far as like Lightning Network specifically, I'm a big Lightning Network cheerleader. I hope Lightning does great things. I also try not to bank my Bitcoin narrative on any particular, say, second layer solution like Lightning Network, because, you know, it does have a lot of bugs. It has a lot of engineering problems it has to work through. And I'm willing to accept that, you know, it very well could, you know, not work out. In fact, you know, a worst case scenario is we do have a lot of centralized second layer solutions that we would be using to buy things, which ultimately is just no change in the status quo as far as what I use to pay at the grocery store and stuff like that. However, I do believe that even on the two sides of that spectrum, where one is like actually Lightning Network is they fix all of the potential bugs. It's just this giant, wonderful decentralized network of you know, routing Bitcoin micropayments between everyone, and that's our sort of main second layer way of doing things. And you know, I use my phone to send a Lightning payment to the grocery store. Or it's in the like, well, I actually have to deposit Bitcoins into, you know, say, you know, Visa or PayPal or whatever. And I have to still use a card that has Visa on it to swipe that at the grocery store. Regardless, on both sides of that spectrum, the important thing to me is that those payments are now denominated in Bitcoins. So obviously, like, I do want more privacy. I want, more individual sovereignty over the coins. So I don't mean to, like, say this as a way of, like, I don't care about those things, because I do. But from a sort of macroeconomic point of view, I care about the fact that it's denominated in Bitcoin, so that when I'm making those economic decisions, they're being priced in Bitcoin, so I can make long-term economic planning for myself.
I was thinking in terms of, say, a lot of people considering holding Bitcoin as an asset, and over a sort of 30-year period, if you were to sell any of that asset, you're potentially losing the ability to have it work for you. So in that sense, your future involves you relinquishing some of your Bitcoin in, mm-hmm. As in spending it, rather than, say, leveraging it or for something. Or, you know, I'm interested to know, whether that's what the scenario in the future ends up being, or certainly what you think it is.
Sure. So I think if I'm understanding the question correctly, there will be a time in which there is a sort of equilibrium with the Bitcoin price, in the way that the value of the dollar is rather stable, because it has, it's a very saturated market for the dollars. Bitcoin will also reach that state. However, the point is, when competing currencies are competing, one will dominate the other. And so the actual level at which that is extremely high, where, you know, the dollar is, rather than, $10,000. So it's going to be quite a ride before we get to such a state. Now, if we imagine, we call that state, hyper-Bitcoinization. If we imagine post-hyper-Bitcoinization, the price of Bitcoin is relatively stable, or growing at a, kind of relatively stable rate or whatever. At that point, there are going to be opportunities to invest that money that can have a better return than Bitcoin itself. Because at that point, if the whole world is using Bitcoin as a reserve currency, the price of Bitcoin is increasing based on the growth of the economy. But necessarily within that growth of the economy, there exist entrepreneurial efforts that are actually doing even better than that. There's also going to be some that do worse than that. And so it will be useful to be able to invest in entrepreneurial projects, just like we do today, in order to beat the dollar, or even beat the S&P 500, which people seem to use more as their savings vehicle.
That's certainly answered my question. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I got a quick question about how you see the future regarding KYC coins and non-KYC coins. How are you thinking about that? Do you see a different price to different markets emerging for this?
I don't know that I have any very strong opinions on that. I will say up front that I think that KYC AML is a disgrace. It comes out of, like, terrible Keynesian policies, where they want to be able to control how all of the money moves. And then they turn it into a national security threat as well, because they'll give you the kinds of things that they throw at crypto anarchists as well. Just like, all the bad people will get to do the bad things unless we have total control of your finances. And by the way, if we have total control of your finances, we also get to inflate everything away. So, like, the Bank Secrecy Act, like, that's a really, like, weird, shady thing, the passing of it. So, like, that part of it, I don't like that at all. I think KYC is going to be a part of Bitcoin, in the sense of, when you interact with other people, Bitcoin itself is trustless, but the person selling you goods and the person that you're giving loans to, they are another person that you have to trust will be able to give back money or sell you the goods or whatever. So there's going to be bits of information they need. Now, that doesn't mean you need to send over a blood sample and you know, all of that. It could just mean like, you know, it could even just be KYC in the form of a GPG public key. Like that would sort of be the, I guess, lowest level, but people are going to have some level of like identification. With regards of where that's going to end up, I really don't know. I want a more private and sovereign Bitcoin. But I also, given how people value privacy in empirically, I don't really foresee that. But I also don't know that the prices are going to be that much different because with things like gold, it's very difficult to actually assay the gold when it gets to you. So you do have to like do some amount of like tracking and like see how it was minted and everything so you can make sure that it was like good gold. So I know that the London markets have like very strict standards around like the quality and everything. And that's going to tend to be like, shall we say, like white market gold that goes like this. Say if I'm wrong about any of this, please correct me. But with Bitcoin, you know, all of these so-called taint is ultimately heuristics that humans individually impose on Bitcoin rather than something that's baked into the Bitcoin protocol. As far as the protocol goes, Bitcoin is fungible. Because of that, like people can still use a full node to know that they actually have the Bitcoins they think they have. So I guess my ultimate point is when we look at that, whatever we see in other markets that can actually be chalked up to quality control is not needed in Bitcoin. And my understanding of the gold market as someone who's not sophisticated in that, to be very clear, is that a lot of the sort of white market stuff like we see with the London bullion market has to do with quality control rather than intense government oversight in terms of like privacy stuff. Safe, can you correct me on that?
I think I probably agree with you, but I'd add it's in the case of gold, it's also just to ensure that the market is crippled and that you can't develop a free market monetary system on top of gold. And that's very easy to do with gold, because if you wanted to develop a free market monetary system around gold, you still need to be lugging around bars of gold and coins of gold from one bank to the other, and from one country to the other, and from one city to the other, and from one continent to the other. And that is extremely expensive and extremely vulnerable to state capture. You know, there are only a few airports in every country and a few seaports, and you know, they're just not going to let you go in and out with your gold freely. If you had that, then you would have a free market in gold, and then government monies would go out of business. So the powerful thing about Bitcoin is that it, you know, they can add all of that on their own KYC compliant platform. So you can have banks that are KYC compliant that implement all of these things, but you can still take, you know, you can always take your money out of that and then just clear and then just transact on the Bitcoin network itself. And currently transaction fees are extremely low. And I think they have a long way to go, considering the value proposition. If you think about it as a clearance system, because you know the competition is gold clearance. The competition in terms of the value is gold clearance. So we have an enormous amount of leeway, in a sense, with Bitcoin transactions, because whatever they try and impose on KYC'd Bitcoin and institutional Bitcoin, it can't be too onerous, I think, because people can just go off chain or go to jurisdictions and countries that don't have this these kinds of problems. And so, you know, you can see how some governments will do these things to try and limit it, but all they're going to be doing is that they're just going to get everybody in their jurisdiction and in their financial institutions to withdraw their Bitcoin and send it elsewhere. Bitcoin is just so much more saleable across space, and that's the point that I'm going to be focusing on in my next book, The Fiat Standard. The ability to move Bitcoin across space just makes it a very different game than gold. So that's, I think, that's the engineering feature other than NGU that makes Bitcoin so powerful. Just you can send $1 billion of Bitcoin in an hour across the world, or a couple of hours, which you can't do with anything else. All right. Well, yeah.
Sorry, I don't have like a fantastic answer to the KYC thing. It's just, it's very up in the air. Yeah. And it's also ultimately, if the status quo stayed the same, but we lived in an economy that had a hard money as its base, I do believe that that would be an improvement. But that is an extreme worst case, thankfully. I think that we're going to have something way, way better than merely the status quo with sound money.
I think so too. I'm optimistic of the same. All right. Well, now let's move on toward the topic of meat and Bitstein's other website, other than Satoshi Nakamoto Institute's website, which is justmeat.co. And I highly recommend this. And in it, Michael has connected maybe all of the good writings that have been written about the eating of meat over the years. And Michael has done incredible research about this, much more than I have. I'm generally kind of a bit of a shortcut taking kind of person. And so, you know, for me, the way that I approach this diet is, instead of reading, I'm just going to make more steak. And that has worked well for me. So I haven't read as much as Michael has. And so it's great to be having Michael on board to tell us about some of these amazing readings that you have collected on Just Meat. And some of them are much older than you'd expect. You know, the idea of eating meat only is only becoming part of people's understanding only very recently. Like 5 years ago when we started, anybody that I would mention this to would think I'm crazy. Now, not everybody, the majority only thinks I'm crazy. A few people think, oh, you're crazy, but there are other crazy people like you. But in fact, we see that Wilhelm Stephenson was writing about this about 100 years ago. And so, Michael, tell us more about Stephenson.
Well, you know, I would say, you know, Sean Baker, our friend, puts it best, because people are like, oh, you're the creator of the carnivore diet or whatever. And he's like, no, some caveman invented this. I'm just doing it too. But you make the good point, is even in the sort of modern sense, in these hard Neolithic times, the consumption of a meat heavy, if not meat only, diet is not something that's new, and has been covered extensively over the past, you know, century and a half, if not more. And so it's a mistake that people make. They see that it's becoming more popular, and so it's immediately derided as a fad. Seems to be one of those words, like in, I guess, nutrition and lifestyle, to degrade, you know, anything that's kind of outside the current status quo. But in reality, it's not like it's a fad in the sense of a new idea. It's just that people are looking into an idea with more popularity. So there's
agriculture is a fad. Agriculture has only been around for a few thousand years.
Yeah, compared to, you know, hundreds of, you know, millions of years of human evolution, since we, you know, diverged from, you know, Pan, and, you know, they went off to be chimpanzees and we went off to be humans. It's been a very long time. So as far as the literature goes, I think Stephenson is a great place to start, because he was someone who he had, as far as I know, he wasn't like reading about the fact that, you know, there are people out there who eat only meat. He was living it. So Vilmer Stefanson was a Harvard trained anthropologist who went to live with the Inuit for, I believe he lived with them for a total of maybe 10 to 15 years, if not more. And he was in the Arctic. He wrote many books on the subject, just looking at their lifestyle. And, you know, just he was very interested in the North, in the Arctic. So he came back and he was telling everyone how, so, you know, there's not really plants up there. It's very hard, except for like seasonal berries. It's very difficult to find plants in the Arctic. So obviously you're not going to be able to eat them. I suppose at best you'll find some plant matter in the stomachs of a killed animal. But he saw that, you know, there's no plants and everyone basically just eats meat. So they would, you know, eat things like a lot of fish, blubber from whales and seals, lots of caribou, and all this stuff. And that's what they lived on. And they were actually tremendously healthy. He felt extremely healthy eating like that. And when he came back and was telling people this, they didn't believe him. And he actually underwent with another Arctic explorer, buddy of his, a guy named Anderson. They underwent a study at Bellevue Hospital where for a year they ate nothing but fatty meat, as well as some organs. And what they found at the end was that other than a few adaptation issues at the beginning, by the end, they could not find any sort of deficiency in either. And in fact, both of them were quite healthy by the end. And to this day, this comes to people with disbelief. But Stefanson went on to write a book called Not Bright Bread Alone, which he later revised in the 50s, a book called The Fat of the Land. And in that, he talks all about basically the how the Inuit show us all these misconceptions of health, looking and primarily nutrition, because of the fact that they eat only meat and yet are so healthy. So he talks about a lot about the different things they eat from the animals, how they eat a very high fat diet, how they don't really have dentists and yet, you know, their, you know, mouths have impeccable dental health, which was later confirmed by the work of, you know, Weston Price, or I guess it was around the same time, vaguely. Weston Price was also doing research, and when he visited the Inuit, he found that they were the, you know, he actually called them, I don't remember the exact phrasing he used, but he was like, these are the healthiest people I've come across after traveling the world. And he found very, very little evidence of tooth decay. I think they had to look through 1,000 teeth before finding a single tooth that had decay. Stefanson also wrote a book about cancer, pointing out how the Inuit at the time, they didn't even have a conception of what cancer was because they didn't experience it, which raises a lot of questions about what might be the reason. So Stefanson, his book inspired a lot of others, and that later went down the line. And one of the famous people who is ultimately inspired by Stefanson was a guy named Augustus Owsley Stanley III.
We'll get to the bear. We'll get to the bear. But before we move on, I just wanted to point out, you know, people today have this conception of the science as being whatever stupid bullshit comes out of a press release from stupid fiat universities. And so immediately, you know, the carnivore diet or eating meat is immediately dismissed as not scientific because, you know, none of the stupid modern nutrition departments that promote junk food have issued a press release about the benefits of meat. So clearly this can't be good. And of course, you know, this is just fiat science. It's the idea of science as belief and authority appointed by government and funded by government. What we see with Stefan's son is actually quite it's really scientific. You know, they did an experiment. What science actually is experimentation. You propose a hypothesis and then you experiment it. And so you start with an observation, which is that this man went to the Arctic and saw all these people who survived and thrived without plant food, and that's a striking observation. So you make the hypothesis that you can live without plants, and then you experiment on it. And the experiment was two grown adult men who were observed at a hospital for an entire year where they ate nothing but meat, and there was nothing wrong with them. They didn't die. They didn't witness any deficiencies. So it's amazing. But somehow, you know, modern science just completely ignores this. It's an experiment, but, you know, it just doesn't fit with modern science because it's not got a press release that's financed by Monsanto, and so it's not scientific. And the other thing is, we are lucky enough to have a little bit of a modern-day Monsanto, modern-day Stefansson among our attendees today. Timothy Allen, who asked you an earlier question, he's a photographer and travel, I should say travel journalist. Would that be accurate, Timothy, or a documentary maker? What do you prefer?
All of the above.
And he's traveled to Greenland and to all kinds of Arctic places. And I'm curious about you. We've discussed this briefly before, you and I, but can you share some of your dietary adventures in the North Pole?
I can't give you any evidence-based results, but certainly I've worked in a lot of places where people's diets are predominantly meat. It's the same on the steppe in Mongolia. It's very hard to grow anything in particular other than meat. We did a film once in Greenland where we were filming the locals catching Greenland sharks, which are these incredibly deep diving large sharks. And what was interesting, it turned out, and I didn't know this, that they're one of the highest concentrated forms of vitamin C that you can find. And, you know, I've always thought of vitamin C as something you got from you know, lemons and limes and stuff like that. One thing you did say that was interesting, though, when you were talking about the Inuit not having any understanding of what cancer was, what do you mean by that? What is cancer? You know, like how do you diagnose something like cancer? You know, anyway, like what was that?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think is basically the argument is like the clinical signs that we have of cancer were not observed and were not known to the Inuit prior to a certain time.
Right.
Okay. I think the shark one, is that the one from Human Planet?
Yes.
Where they make the hole and they have to put the incredibly long line.
But I mean, I think everything that you think about, you know, that a meat only diet, that it's easy to sort of dispel a lot of the myths when you sort of research it a little bit. And that was the one for me. I've often thought about things like that, the things we naturally associate with fruits and plants. And
right.
I mean, I did a 3-week trip in Siberia in winter, and we only ate meat on that trip. Or raw meat, only raw meat and raw fish. And it's incredible the transformation that happened to my body in that time. I mean, it was a tough trip anyway because it was super cold and it was middle of winter. But the funny thing was that, you know, I distinctly remember on the first night thinking, what the hell are we doing? You know, we were, you know, you were either eating frozen sushi, essentially, straight off of fish, or you were killing a reindeer and, first of all, drinking warm blood immediately, which I've done a couple of times actually in a few different places, and you tend to brace yourself before you do, imagining that there's going to be some kind of unusual taste. But in the Arctic, funny enough, it's like oxtail soup. I did it in Africa once, and it was I'm not being funny here. It actually tasted like a very rich wine, a completely wow. different taste. And then you just literally strip the meat off the animal and eat it there and then. And in the beginning, I remember thinking this is unusual. But even after 2 to 3 weeks, we were looking forward to those moments of doing it. And I lost, I think, in 3 weeks. My health is a very up and down thing anyway, but I lost I think over a stone and a half in weight. And you know, it's very noticeable in me when I'm healthy. I'm not very healthy at the moment, you know. We've been locked down at home getting drunk most nights, you know, but like when I'm, you know, you could see my face transform. And it was purely obviously from that diet plus a very strenuous lifestyle with it,
right?
But yeah, I mean, it's something you can get into. I mean, in the case of the Inuit as well, or in Siberia, you don't even cook it. You know, there's no readily accessible ways to heat up your food, and most of the time you're moving every other day. So you know, the thought of setting up a stove and cooking something is something it's not really on your mind. So you literally just keep it frozen in blocks of ice, and you kind of like strip it off and eat it. But it's a surprisingly satisfying thing once you get used to it.
Right. So first of all, we're going to have to go on some trips after Bitcoin moons to experience this again. Yeah, I think your points about vitamin C are very interesting, and I think very surprising to people, because that's one of the most common things we hear, you know, when you say, oh, I'm on an all meat diet, is, oh, but what about vitamin C? You're going to get scurvy. And the interesting thing is, well, the simple science is, well, I've eaten basically only meat for 5 years, and I show no signs of scurvy. So at the very least, we can falsify that version of the claim. But then, you know, the thing is we later find that the ways of thinking about vitamin C were all wrong. So perhaps there's actually is meat in vitamin C in meat. Amber O'Hearn, who's a wonderful carnivore researcher who I've learned very much a lot from. In fact, this is who I first learned about carnivory from, pointed out that the measurements for vitamin C in meat are listed as zero in government databases, with a reference code saying that, well, they just assumed that it was zero. So there might actually be enough in meat for it to matter. But then it gets stranger when you look into Stefansson, because you find out that in the Arctic, they knew that fresh meat was the cure to scurvy. So Stefansson describes people on his trip who were coming down with scurvy. Turned out that they had a bunch of like canned biscuits and stuff that they were eating. But as soon as they ate fresh meat, you know, presumably like raw and all that, for like, you know, 3 days, the scurvy was gone. And so there's something about the meat that's able to counter scurvy, whether or not it's the vitamin C in the first place, or if it's like, there's also the idea that vitamin C competes with glucose for the metabolic pathways. And so if you're consuming more glucose, you actually do need more vitamin C in order to even get enough inside you. Whereas if you're not eating the glucose, then you only need as much vitamin C as the actual raw amount that you need to absorb. So it's like the paper value versus what you actually absorb. And then additionally, there's another idea that, well, vitamin C is used to deal with oxidation in the body, like a sort of antioxidant type thing. But if you're eating a very clean ketogenic diet with a lot of meat, so like a Paleolithic ketogenic diet, you don't have as much oxidation going on in the body, so you don't even need as much vitamin C. And we see similar patterns in other nutrients as well. So for instance, magnesium, There's a group in Hungary called Paleo Medicina. They have a longer name now. That's their official name, but I always forget what it's called. It's like International Center for Nutritional Medical Intervention or something like that. They work with patients by basically feeding them meat, fat, and organs at a very high fat level to induce ketosis. And they use it for treatment of all kinds of autoimmune conditions, as well as cancers, which they've had varying levels of success with, which itself is very fascinating. But they've done studies on the magnesium because the paper value of the magnesium that people are consuming on that diet is well below the RDA. However, all of their patients have normal levels of magnesium in the blood. So what they find and what you can surmise is that when you look at the glycolytic versus ketotic metabolisms, the steps to go through turning glucose into energy versus what it takes to turn fat into energy, the glucose one requires many steps that use up a lot of magnesium. So what they argue is that you consume more magnesium and you need to consume more magnesium because your body is also consuming more magnesium. But if you're in a ketotic state, your body is not having to deplete as much magnesium in order to create energy. And so the balance actually works out just fine eating a smaller amount of magnesium. And so even all these like RDA things, it's like, they're interesting. Like perhaps they're even right to some degree in a sort of standard diet. But we find so many people are eating, you know, say only meat, and the RDAs don't quite seem to apply in the same way. And that's also missing the point that most of the RDAs are covered by meat anyway.
Yeah. And I think, you know, an important thing to keep in mind is that with these RDAs, it's constructivist science. It's a bunch of people sitting in a lab and figuring out, all right, what should be the correct amount of this thing in the blood and that thing in the blood. And, initially you might think, well, obviously they have their correct theories and science that they've been doing for hundreds of years to arrive at these numbers. But in reality, it's like pretty much every modern field of study in fiat academia, it's just basically bad statistics. So you look at the average American, you take a measurement from 10,000 Americans, and you look at the mean, and you look at the standard deviation, and you assume that everything within one standard deviation is normal, everything within two standard deviations is high or low, and everything more than two standard deviations is dangerous. And, that sounds like it would make sense, but the average American is not the pinnacle of health. And going by that as the standard is, in my mind, it's maybe a useful guess, but it's treated like it is scripture where, you know, you need to meet this standard. And of course, if we had actual scientific methodology, all it would take is one example to falsify a theory like that. Like all you would need is one person who doesn't eat vitamin C according to the RDAs and doesn't develop scurvy to make you revisit that entire theory. But of course, modern fiat science doesn't do that. They just, there are thousands of people who have lived without plants and carbohydrates and have benefited from carbohydrates. And it has absolutely had no effect on the dietary guidelines that are pushed by fiat nutritionists and fiat doctors on people. They still tell you to eat your 6 to 10 portions of grain per day. And I think this is the difference between science as a stupid ritual and science as a method of experimentation. And I wanted to ask you, Tim, here, because this is quite interesting. And in Weston Price, when he traveled around 100 years ago, the interesting thing about his work was he would see the Inuit tribes, for instance, that were isolated, that hadn't traded with European colonial, with Europeans, and so hadn't eaten sugar and flour, and they wouldn't have any examples of tooth decay or cancer or diabetes or any of the modern diseases. And then he'd go a few hundred kilometers closer to white settlements, and he'd find there, you know, there'd be an Inuit settlement where people do trade with Europeans. And so they have been consuming sugar and flour for the last couple of decades. And there you find the tooth decay and you find all of the diseases of modernity. So I'm curious about how the situation is now in the places where you've traveled, Tim. Like, did you see people who are still eating only meat, or did you guys bring them some biscuits and flour and ruin their health?
The last place I've been, like I say, Siberia, the Yamal Peninsula, and you could quantify it quite simply as there are two different ways to live in Yamal Peninsula. One of them is as a Russian in the Russian regime, and another one is to be a nomadic herder. You can't mix the two. If you're a nomadic herder, you live in a chum, which is a tent, and you move 2,000 kilometers a year. So you have to live the old way. And the beautiful thing about the Nenets, that particular people I was living with at the time, is most of their culture has not been superseded by a modern version as yet, because it hasn't been topped. So for example, they can afford to buy a skidoo, and they might have one skidoo, but the majority of the way they travel is is with reindeers pulling them along, because it's much easier to maintain and they don't lose, you know, like it's much cheaper. Same with the clothes. You can go and buy a North Face down jacket if you want, but they still use reindeer skins. They even use reindeer boots, which is pretty much just two reindeer skins back to back with a little bit of sort of, you know, straw in the middle. And that's good down to minus 50. Your Baffin boots aren't good down to minus 50, you know, and all these things. So, and the same goes with diet. When you're moving every other day, and you have to set up a tent as well, and you have to saddle up all your animals, and you have to, you know, you don't want to crack open, you know,
the Pringles a
meal in the evening. When you get to where you're going, you put up a shelter, you get inside it, you don't heat it, and then you sort of like take strips of frozen fish off the side of a fish that you caught like 10 weeks ago. That's in, you know, so. Those kind of things. So I would postulate then that when you're living like that, you're fine when you're eating just meat. When you're living in a sort of Soviet style village, there are lots of things which are ruining those villages, which have come from the outside. Alcohol is another classic example.
Yeah.
It has a horrendous effect on people in those places, much more so than it would in my hamlet here. You know, there's plenty of alcohol here, but we're not insanely, you know, walking around with nothing else to do except get drunk on the strongest vodka we can find, you know. And there are many things. I think that the trick being, if you can stick to the way it was, you should be all right. And I think a classic example in that is fat, because you know, I grew up being taught that fat was the boogeyman. Don't eat fat; it's terrible. You know, if you're going to eat a bit of meat, eat the lean bit of the meat. And what you discover in many places where meat is the single most consumed thing is that the fat is the bit everyone wants, and the lean bit is used for often other things. And as you go down the pecking order of who's eating what. You know, the most, it's like in Mongolia, it's the same. The bit of the animal that you present to the most honored person at your table is that backside bit on a sheep. And it's like a huge mound of fat, and it's white and gooey when you eat it. I mean, it's phenomenal, you know. But I think if you mix fatty meat with, you know, like loads of gunky food from the supermarket as well, it probably does have a terrible effect on you. I mean, this is something that you guys will be able to back me up on, but that's the sense I get. It's what you mix together that causes the problems, and not the diet that you stick to.
Very much so. So you would say, I mean, obviously you didn't do medical checkups on people there, but you would say that people who are still living the traditional nomadic lifestyle, they don't have obesity and diabetes and these health problems.
I don't know about, I mean, they're certainly not obese. You can't be obese there.
Yeah.
You've got to work. all day, every day, and you eat when you can, you know. I mean, obesity is a disease of the people with a lot of time on their hands, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, when you go back there, tell them whatever they do, you know, they can take all of the stupid bullshit from our civilization. Just stay away from sugar and white flour. That's the most important thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, I suppose out of everywhere I've ever traveled, I consider those Northern Hemisphere people as the toughest people on the planet. They certainly live in the most extraordinary situation you can live in. And as a result, they are super tough. Now, you know, the diet is all part of that, without a shadow of a doubt. But you acclimatized to anything in the end. And for example, in Siberia, in midwinter, it's always about minus 40 to minus 45, which is serious. You know, if you go outside for a shit, you know, you've got 25, 30 seconds to get it done before it starts like being dangerous for you, you know, to get back somewhere out of the cold. Wow. But those guys, literally, they'll ride a skidoo at 60 miles an hour for 3 or 4 hours nonstop with the wind rushing into their face at the same temperature, and their faces don't freeze. I got frostbite on the end of my nose. You can still see it. And I was really sheltered. So there's a different, there's a different genetic makeup at work there. I suspect, but they're different human beings. They're really, you know, adapted completely differently than we are. Whether or not we could change, I don't know, because, you know, I'm not planning on spending that long out there.
On that topic, so because I think this is an important point. So first off, I think people should go watch the episode of Tribe with Bruce Perry on the Nenets. It's a really fun one.
He got pretty bad frostbite on his cheek, didn't he?
Yeah, and I mean you can watch them eating the raw caribou with the blood and everything. It's a great episode, but. You know, that's an important point of like, well, how do we know that it's not just a genetic thing versus a dietary thing versus something else? And this is why Weston Price is so fascinating, because he went to all corners of the globe. He was unable to go to Asia because of some, I think there were some political problems at the time, but he was able to go all over. And he found the same pattern everywhere. And each one of the groups, even if they weren't eating as much meat, so for instance, the Swiss, they were in this valley, like they have enough cows for dairy, but they couldn't you know, consume a lot of meat. They were eating a lot of rye bread. They always highly valued and prized and treasured the animal foods. But even beyond that, you see meat-heavy people in all corners of the globe. So in North America and in Asia and Europe, you have the, you know, the Sami and the Inuit and the Nenets, etc. But you can also go to more southern climes, and you go to, you know, the North American plains, and you have the Plains Indians eating a meat-heavy diet. Like the Comanches were living off bison. And the Comanches, I mean, they extended down to, you know, here in Texas. They were still, you know, attacking Texan settlements until like the 1850s or so. So there's that. Then I think Weston Price describes the Incan, not the Incan, but also in the Peruvian area, groups that were eating tremendous amounts of meat. He describes the Maasai and describes them as being the healthiest and most formidable of the Africans that he was meeting. He describes the Maori and the Aborigines in Australia and New Zealand, not respectively, I got those backwards, but both of those as being extremely healthy, and they were primarily eating meat at the time. And so on and so forth. And we already described, say, the Mongols and these other groups. And so you do see this pattern emerging across the globe, as well as in Europe, you know, Paleolithic stuff in Europe, you know, from the Yamanyas, or I always forget how to pronounce that, but there was a sort of Paleolithic group of very bloodthirsty Europeans. Caesar described some Germanic tribes as only eating meat and milk. Herodotus described a Northern African group, I think they would have been from Libya, eating all meat. Stuff found
think,
in
you know Spain. Also the Mongols I think is very much right. worth mentioning because they conquered the majority of the world at that time, and one of the main advantages was their diet and how much stronger it made them, but also just how much more mobile they were because they could travel with their horses, they could ride the horses, and they could eat the horses, and that was just an enormous amount of mobility, an enormous amount of mobility for a lot of power, which farmers couldn't compete with. Farmers needed to grow the crops and then they needed to transport the crops and they needed expensive equipment and time-consuming procedures to prepare the food in order to feed their soldiers. So it's well worth thinking about.
If I had to make
I think you just hit the nail on the head there. I think when you're a pastoralist, when you move around, as traditionally, I suspect we all did, if you go back far enough, it's a bit of a zero-sum game. If you're following animals around and eating them at the same time, you're not incentivized to grow food. I mean, you don't need to. It's the same. We have this joke in Mongolia that Mongolia is full of the most incredible salmon rivers you'll ever find, with nobody fishing in them. And we always say to the guys, why don't you fish these rivers? And they're like, what's the point? We've got sheep and goats and camels and horses, whatever. But, there's no incentive to catch fish. And I think there's also no incentive. If you look at, hunter-gatherer tribes, you're looking for meat, basically. Or if you're a pastoralist in Africa, you're cultivating your meat. And if you get a little bit of veg, it's normally something scavenged, small little treats. There's no need to find that thing. And I think that's the thing. Once you settle down and start cultivating a crop, you've invested in that whole idea of growing crops, and it's a different way to do it. And it suits a lot of people, but if you maintain a lifestyle on the move where you basically follow animals, which is what all herders do, they're kind of herding their animals, but they're just following grass. The whole point, every nomadic community in the world that's still nomadic is pushing their animals to places where the grass is. And in fact, in the Nenets, they don't even push them. They follow them. They follow their herd. If they've got 2,000 reindeer in their herd, they're following that herd. They're not even, and the herd knows where to go. They go north in the winter and south in the summer, and they're after the grass. So, why would you grow veg when you can just,
I think, to be fair, I think, the advantages of sedentary life are that it allows people to lower their time preference to start investing. You build a home and you can keep it and you can trust that it's going to be passed on to your children. All of that wouldn't be possible if we were traveling 2,000 kilometers a year. So I think, there are advantages to sedentary civilization. But I think the cost to our bodies has been absolutely devastating, and it's been a slow process where arguably we've become shorter and dumber and weaker over the past few thousand years because of agriculture. I think that that's probably fair.
It's standard anthropology to see the difference in Paleolithic versus Neolithic man. I don't even think that's up for debate.
Yeah.
But Bitcoin changes the, economic incentives of people. And if we start thinking longer term, our body is capital as well. And so we're going to want to do whatever shows good results for maintaining that bodily capital. And I think barring government edicts to follow a particular dietary pattern, which unfortunately the government has found ways to incentivize all sorts of, negative eating patterns, people will tend towards the ones that work the best. And I happen to think that there's a reason that those peoples all around the world throughout the anthropological literature that we find we're doing so well, and it has to do with the nutrition of fatty meat.
Yeah. And so I guess now the next thing to discuss would be the bear, Stanley Owsley. What, tell us more about that fascinating man.
Yeah, so Owsley Stanley, known as the bear, was probably most famously known as being, I guess, one of the first mass manufacturers of LSD in the United States, I guess the world. So he was supplying all the hippies with their LSD, and he was specifically known for making sort of the most pure LSD. Now that's something that's about as far as my knowledge goes on that part of it. He was also like the sound guy for the Grateful Dead, where he was doing quite innovative work in terms of like the sound engineering with the he created the infamous wall of sound for the Grateful Dead, and he also introduced the idea of like having the monitor speakers so that the players could kind of, you know, actually hear themselves and better adjust their playing while they're on stage. So he was very you know, multifaceted guy. He descended from a Kentucky senator, you know, he's salt of the earth kind of American guy. He was he describes himself as having like gotten, you know, overweight and unhealthy in his early 20s, and when he was about 23, he discovered a book called Eat Fat and Grow Thin by it's on my website. McCannis, I think the name was. Someone would have to, you know, go look that up. But he read that book and it just changed his life. And I think that had references to Stefansson. So he also read Stefansson. So when he was like 23 or 24, he took up the, you know, what we'd call a carnivore diet. And he lived on that for 50 years. And you know, he was very healthy. He did have a couple of health problems. It wasn't a cure all for him, for the stuff, but he was able to take up bodybuilding in his 50s and put on, you know, 30 pounds of muscle. He was well known for being, you know, a tough guy and everything. In about 2006, he appeared on a low carb forum and just, you know, in classic, you know, internet kind of shitposting, you know, he just drops an op in a thread that's just like, yeah, the correct human diet is an all meat one. Ask me anything. And he's just like, he made it kind of short and sweet, you know, just a little bit of just, you know, yeah, you should only eat. I've been doing this for a long time. And he just fields questions from all over. He wasn't really interested you know, convincing anyone per se. He was just, this is what I've done and I know I'm right. And I'm going to tell you all of what I know. And he just fields questions on everything, like everything we've discussed. Probably not as much on the anthropology or anything, but, you know, as far as all of the nutrition, he just covers everything. And this was one of my first kind of red pills into meat eating, was just reading through Owsley Stanley's forum posts and reading his responses to all of this stuff. And what you get is the sense is like, you know, this is a guy on the internet. You don't know if he's right or not, but was quite fascinating. It's one of these things where it's, you don't think that eating only meat is reasonable in the first place, but it's like, this is a guy who's thought it through to the point where at the end you're like, okay, like there's at least a plausible answer for all of these concerns. That doesn't mean he's right, but it kind of removes like the idea that there's no possible plausible explanation. And it actually kind of, you know, helped inspire me to want to try doing it. And I think a lot of old time zero carbers have found that he was basically right about a lot of what he said, even if he did not do it based on, you know, citing studies and whatever. He was talking almost purely from personal experience and kind of what he'd picked up along the way.
Yeah, this is what I found the absolutely most fascinating thing about it. I mean, we had the internet and we had thousands of people all over the world trying things out. Like, this is how I learned about this, going on Facebook forums and finding people from all over the world saying, you know, I tried this and it made me feel that way. And then I tried that. And then several people will corroborate that. And then you get an idea. All right, maybe I should try this. And then you try it. But this guy, you know, he discovered this in the, what was it, 60s or 70s?
This would have been the 50s.
Yeah, in the 50s, he went into library, picked up chemistry and biology books and figured it all out. And by 2006, he was going online and just telling people all of those things. And it sounded extremely crazy. But the more you dig in, the more you realize, yep, that guy seems to know exactly what he's talking about. And he just continues to get validated. And it's absolutely amazing to think that, you know, a sound engineer who was also another point that Michael didn't mention, he was world famous for producing LSD. Before LSD was illegal, he was one of the people who was producing a lot of it. And so you wouldn't associate that with somebody who has a very good command of nutrition science, but he would just log on to all of these forums and explain how the body works and what is the ideal diet. And he was right about a lot of it.
There's great stories of the Grateful Dead stayed at his house in Los Angeles sometime, I guess, maybe in the early 70s. And the Grateful Dead, they open up his fridge and all there is just large slabs of raw meat. And that's all that he's, it was like, that's all you're going to eat in my house. And they would talk about, you know, Jerry Garcia would, you know, sneak out back and just eat some candy bars that they hid somewhere. And I don't like to joke about the dead, but, you know, Jerry Garcia later, I believe, died of diabetes, or at least he suffered from diabetes. So, there is a bit of a lesson in there, I perhaps.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. You feel this all the time as a carnivore. You're constantly getting mocked and laughed at by people whose health is in much worse shape than you. And it's sad. Like, I think about all the people that have laughed at me because I eat meat only. And, you know, you want to laugh back, but it's much less funny if you laugh back when they have serious health problems. Like, it's okay to laugh at people who look healthy like me because, you know, you're an idiot, you're eating all meat. But, you know, if I wanted to talk back, it wouldn't be as funny to some of the people who are not eating meat only and suffering all kinds of health problems. And it's amazing because with there was a culture of people doing all kinds of drugs all the time. And this guy just manages to find the secret to health. And he lives, how old was he when he died?
He was in his, I think, early 70s or late 70s.
Yeah, and he died in the car crash.
In his 70s, yeah. Now he did have I think his two big health scares. One was a heart attack that he had in his, I believe, late 50s, and then he had cancer closer to the end of his life. Now the heart attack, he blames the broccoli, the broccoli that he ate that his mom made him eat as a kid, and people laugh at that. His argument, what he claims is that it only came about as an issue after he became a bodybuilder, because his body was needing a lot more blood pumped through his body. Mm-hmm. So places where his arteries had been clogged a bit early on, that hadn't been an issue until suddenly there needed more blood flow. He claims that when they opened him up for bypass surgery, based on how the arteries, like sort of new branches of veins and arteries had been built, it's rather plausible that it had been a problem that had existed for a long time that his body was trying to route around. He does say that his cardiologists agreed that his way of eating was good for heart health, but that people wouldn't believe it. Now, all of these things, I have no way to verify any of this. Look, it might be something else that he was doing, which also brings up the cancer, which he had throat cancer. And, frankly, he was a hippie who was engaging in a lot of other behaviors outside of nutrition that I would not be probably wanting to engage with myself if I wanted to live in a healthy lifestyle. And that could, you know, being around smoke and all of that, all of those years, among other things, could have played a role in it. And yet, you know, despite that, you know, besides the time he died, he was very healthy. That is to put that out there. It wasn't like he was in perfect health. But it's what I'd say is it's unclear that diet was the reason, or sorry, his meat diet was the reason that he was facing these issues.
Yeah, and it seems quite likely that it was the reason why he managed to survive for about, what was it? How long did he have his cancer for? For a very long time, right?
He had it for a while, and I know he ended up going under a radiation treatment, some chemo or whatever, and it was devastating on his body. Although for him, this is the guy who, when he got sent to prison for the LSD, he talks about trading food with the Muslim inmates because they didn't want pork. Because of their religion. So he would trade them to be able to get pork so that he could continue to eat a meat heavy diet in prison. It was like, nothing was going to stop this guy. So, you know, even through this and doing throat cancer, it's like, well, I'm still going to get my meat. So he would like puree meat and like squirt it down his throat.
Wow.
So, you know, he was very serious about it.
What's your excuse? Yeah. Well, that is absolutely amazing and fascinating stuff. So again, I recommend everybody check out Michael's website. Just
one thing I'd like to correct you on.
Yeah.
Is you can learn about this stuff from even the Harvard. However, you have to go far enough back in time where they still felt free to talk about this. So there's actually a 1929 article from the Harvard Crimson about Eskimo teeth prove health of meat diet. And because the Eskimo teeth they have and all of their Harvard anthropology stuff are just so impeccable, clearly their diets were also very healthy.
Nice. Yeah, I'm going to post a link to that. In the show notes, I'm going to post links to all of the things that we mentioned here, as well as justmeat.co, which contains an enormous number of readings. You could get lost in that webpage for months just reading all the books and articles that are linked there. It's absolutely fascinating stuff. You know, it goes very well as a side with your next ribeye. So speaking of which, how do you make your steaks, Michael?
So unfortunately, I don't have reliable access to good grills. So I don't get to grill as much as I would like. If I could, I'd probably get one of those Otto Wild grills and be scorching the thing at 1500 degrees just long enough to get the sear. I like a good black and blue steak. So I like it as raw in the middle as possible with a really nice crust on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm at home, I'll make the steak. I put the pan on very, very hot. I throw some tallow down sometimes, but usually a nice ribeye has enough fat to do its own thing. And I'll sear that for like a minute, minute and a half on each side. Once again, to just get that nice crust, but have it as raw in the middle as possible. It's how I like it. It's tasty.
Yep. It's really hard to mess up a steak if you have a lot of heat, basically. Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't overcook it, but you'll learn your lesson. The best way to stop overcooking steaks is to overcook a steak and then force yourself to eat it. And then you'll remember the lesson and then you won't overcook it again. That's my tip.
Yeah. Someone asked, what is the best salt to use? I use the Real Salt. It's a brand. It's like one of these, you know, it's like an ancient salt mine that's, you know, pure or whatever. I don't know. you definitely like want to find salt that doesn't have all of the, you know, weird baking powders and stuff in it because you don't know what those agents are. But I guess the way I see it is meat, making a good steak requires at least one ingredient, which is the meat. You can literally just go get a steak and assuming it's from a good source and everything, you can just eat it. You can just, Timothy did, just, you know, go find a caribou, kill it and start stripping meat off it. And it's going to be delicious. From there, you can add salt and you can add fire, but I don't see the need for anything beyond that.
Yeah, pretty much. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to add. Timothy, I think you had something to say. You raised your hand a little bit.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask both of you, actually, the practicalities of this. I've done meat only, and I tend to last a month, at which point I'm amazed at how I've changed, and it's all great. And for some reason, then I relapse, you know, I don't know why. But one of the things that makes it difficult is the logistics of actually just eating meat. And two things in particular. One is when you go out for a meal, you know, you can just order a steak, I get it, but it's not as easy to find places where you just, you know, can do that. The other thing I noticed was, what do you do about, do you guys eat anything else at all? Like, do you, if you one day wake up, have a bit of toast, do you then go out for a run for, you know, whatever? And what about drinking as well? Do you drink, do you have any vices that you allow yourself to sort of like partake in that, you know, does that get in the way of a carnivore diet?
So I've had sparkling water a few times.
That's my party drink. That's like, you know, it's been a nice day, I'm going to bust open a sparkling water. But, you know, this does bring something up that I think is important to address, because a lot of people see, you know, how I tweet or how Safe tweets and just how we talk about meat and stuff. And they take us to be Puritans, as if like, you know, we're imposing our dietary, you know, ideas onto others. And I frankly, I do not care how other people eat. And if they find enjoyment from the foods they eat, that is wonderful. And I wish them the best of health. I'm skeptical about if certain ways of eating can sustain good health. But if they do, and it does, then I'm all for it. And I'm 100% libertarian when it comes to food. I think part of the confusion, though, is I am rather Puritan with myself, just because it's actually out of just a you know, personal preference. So I don't like alcohol, so I stopped drinking it actually before I even became a carnivore. So it's been over 5 years that I haven't had a sip of alcohol, and I frankly don't have any personal interest in it. So I don't have any help for that. As far as other things, it's like, I just like meat. There's not really foods that I miss. So that really doesn't even come up. After a certain amount of time, I will say I used to be a soda junkie, and it took me years to be able to quit soda. Going carnivore was the thing that fixed it for me, because it's kind of an all or nothing proposition at first. It's like when you're first doing it, it's like, well, I need to stick with it. And so you have no option. It's like, it's very binary. It's like, as soon as you have a sip of soda, then you've broken it, and you aren't being a carnivore, or whatever. So being very strict helped me a lot at removing those cravings, and or removing it just from, I shouldn't say the cravings yet, but the it just, you know, I didn't have any in the house, and it kept me psychologically from giving in. But as time went on, all of those cravings went away, and so I didn't even have any thoughts of soda. And this seems to be a very common thing among carnivores, where they lose the cravings for all these foods. People who are, you know, doing keto might still experience more of the cravings because they're indulging in foods, maybe even things that are, you know, potentially considered carnivore, like dairy, but they're more of an indulgement, and they encourage like kind of like eating a lot or whatever, and that's like more in their life. I think those people tend to hold on to more of those cravings. But if you go just like full, you know, meat, for me, the cravings all went away. And if you put donuts in front of me, it literally just does not register as food in my brain anymore.
Yeah, it's the same thing with me. Like, it's just over time, you have less and less desire for that stuff. And I think, you know, what I've come to realize is that a lot of the things that people are stuck to are really You know, you use them as a crutch because of your malnutrition. I think this is the thing that I've come across. Like, I just don't need or desire coffee anymore. And I used to be a major coffee junkie. Like, when I was doing my PhD, I would drink 2 pots of coffee in a day. Like, I brew twice, 2 pots, and I drink them all in a day. And this is what it was like back then. And I just never imagined that I could, you know, be productive without a lot of coffee. But now I just don't even desire it at all. And I think there is, if you need coffee to get out of bed, you're probably malnourished. There's probably not enough energy in your food to sustain you, not enough proteins. And the more meat I eat, the less I want any of that stuff.
There are carnivores and plenty of them that do continue to drink coffee.
That's true, actually. Yeah, so, that's true. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
And one of these days is, once again, it's like you... As far as I can tell, based on all of this research and personal experience, there is no need for the human body to consume anything but meat, fat, potentially organs, to be healthy and live and thrive and all of that. Other things people claim help. I don't think they do, but that's all you need in life. So the way I look at it is just like everything else is just, junk food, in a sense. It's something that you can indulge in if you'd like to, but also know that you don't actually need it. So like, yeah, like someone who's waking, I would tell someone, and regardless of whether they just like coffee or not, if you cannot function in the morning without your coffee, something else is probably going on, and you might consider actually removing the coffee and addressing those other things. But, you know, there's nothing wrong. Like if someone, you know, eats a very healthy diet and then, you know, they happen to also like a bit of toast every once a week or something, and it doesn't harm them, then, you know, all the power to them.
I mean, they just can't be our friend, but they can be.
I think the biggest hurdle for me always would come around. I remember the last time I did it, at about the month mark, we went to Paris for the weekend. And I thought, great, you know, we can go out for a meal. I'll just order a steak. And I did. And then it was just like the thought of a red wine with that steak came such an unbelievable like hole in the menu that I needed to fill. And I thought to myself, that's fine. I'll just do it, you know, because this is I'm going to get a buzz from this wine as well as a kind of taste that I've grown to like. But then what happens after that is the next time I sit down at the table and I'm back home, I think I've lost that kind of, you know, I've fooled myself. And now I think, oh, maybe I'll just have another glass of wine because it was so nice the last time. And
then you ask the restaurant for a glass of blood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would go down well. Yeah, you know, French don't like the English anyway. I'd have it thrown in my face probably.
Yeah, so that is something that a lot of people deal with. And so this actually plays in part of the carnivore worldview, is that these foods, as some of them at least, seem to potentially have a non-linear effect on people. So it's like the kind of thing where it's like you can't merely add, sorry, I'm like hearing another sound.
Mute your mics, anybody. Adam.
You can't merely, eat this, I'm tripping all over myself here. But what we find, to give you an example, there are people who they had, say, like psoriasis or something, and they removed everything. They were doing very low carb, etc. It wasn't until they removed the last, I'll just say like broccoli from their diet that they suddenly saw improvement for the psoriasis. Now, other things they were eating may have been just fine. Maybe it was specifically the broccoli that caused an issue. The point here is that broccoli had sort of a non-linear effect on their health. It's like if you eat a little bit, it's going to cause a massive spike in problems. And my guess is also if you eat a lot of it, it's going to cause even worse problems. So like even small amounts of things can potentially have a massive effect. And if people have trouble imagining this, just think of all of the pharmaceutical drugs people take, and those come in nothing but a small pill, let alone, you know, a whole serving of some food that has, you know, various phytochemicals or, you know, what have you. So because of that, it's like when you know that only you only need one thing to be healthy, adding in the other things, you become more cognizant of like, well, when I eat that, suddenly like I notice like a strong change in my desires for other stuff. And some people might find that, you know, eating, say, like a little bit of very natural raw honey or something does not have these effects on it. I know, you know, in your travels, you've probably seen a lot of crazy stuff with people hunting honey. So some of those people might not have the same, you know, like, oh, suddenly I need, you know, a bunch of ice cream because I ate a little honey. Whereas, you know, eating a little bit of cheese or something might turn on that mechanism. But when I eat strict, I don't find I have any cravings at all. That being said, I haven't left being strict, so I don't know if they come up. For me, I mean.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. And thank you so much, Timothy, for all of the wonderful travel adventures. This is really great. I think we should do
a Bitcoin carnivore Arctic adventure.
Exactly. I think, you know, when as things continue to deteriorate with the whole corona hysteria situation around the world, we probably need to go and join the nomadic tribes of the Arctic in order to escape this. You know, we just need to get our, we need to get ourselves a giant generator of energy that we get the reindeer to chug along, and then that will keep our Bitcoin miners going. And
we keep the satellite to get our blockchain data.
Yes, I think
this is perfect. We'll start the Bitcoin carnivore nomadic tribes. We'll take over the world.
Start from the Arctic and then, you know, work our way down with the rest of the planet.
I know you're joking, but it would be a good idea, in fact. I know a number of places.
Say, if he thinks we're joking.
No, I'm not, yeah.
I'm just saying, I know some places. I mean, I run expeditions around the world, but that's not normally our kind of motivation. But it's always a side effect. Like a lot of the places we go to are very meat-heavy diets. It would be a great retreat to go on a trip to somewhere like, you know, the center of Mongolia and just talk Bitcoin for 2 weeks whilst just eating meat freshly killed, you know, as it with us, you know. And the things like that are surprisingly easy to organize. I kid you not, it's a couple of phone calls and those things
Amazing. Can
come into effect. But I think you might find that the ones in the northern hemisphere, very north, are less enjoyable in the evenings. There's no sitting around discussing Bitcoin, you know, around the fire. It's more like, do I make it to the end of the day? And how can I go to the toilet without feeling embarrassed, you know, with everyone watching me and things like that.
But I guess we could plan it in the summer. It won't be too terrible in the summer, right?
Oh, the summer's worse. In the north, in Siberia, the summer is, I mean, insects are an absolute nightmare. I would prefer the cold than the insects, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Well, and Stefansson talked about the way they dress, you know, the clothing you were describing, you know, he described being in the Arctic as like being in the tropics, because within the clothing, it's able to stay very, very warm. Obviously, your face is covered. So the cold does seem, you know, something you can deal with. Insects, yeah, I don't think I want to deal. I deal enough with that here.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, Timothy, we're going to be talking more about this. Definitely.
No, I'm serious, Saif. I'm serious. It just made me.
I need to start writing some domain names, like, right?
About a year ago, I was talking. I was running an expedition, and two of the guys on the expedition were physicists, and we were having really intense conversations at night. And I remember mentioning, I said, "Wouldn't it be lovely to organize a trip with just physicists, obviously for them, not necessarily for me, where you just go on a journey across the mountains and just talk intensely about things and philosophize and, you know, and eat great food." And it would work really well. I'm thinking aloud here. I'll shut up.
No, absolutely not. You don't have to sell me. I just
I don't think you have to sell anyone who's listening to this right now. No, any of the podcast absolutely. Listeners. I think we're all on board.
Yeah, I think it's just figuring out the logistics and all of the corona restrictions on travel now. That's the one thing that stands in the way. But
Mongolia is still shut. Mongolia is still shut. They're not even opening this year to foreign visitors. They've been shut since the beginning. I was there when they shut originally. You know, we only just got out in time, and they still haven't opened. But they've, you know, they're very, very, very intensely protectivist there. And they don't want coronavirus to get in for some reason. But next summer, maybe.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, it gives us time to let Bitcoin moon a bit more so we can better afford, you know, don't buy family vacations now. Wait until you can take, nomadic excursions later.
Exactly. With reindeer. Yes. Okay. Right. Well, thank you everybody for joining, and thank you, Michael and Timothy. And next week we have as a guest, Jordan Schachtel, a journalist and reporter who's been at the forefront of the Corona hysteria outbreak around the world. And he's going to give us his take on this. So we're going to be discussing that in the next week. So please be sure to join us. Have a good day. Take care. Bye.